From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, T-Bone Burnett plays a few of his latest songs and talks with us about writing them. Burnett is not only a singer, songwriter, and guitarist, he's a record producer. He produced Roy Orbison's comeback album, as well as records by Elvis Costello, Los Lobos, and John Hiatt. Burnett's own new record is his first in 4 years. Also today, tracking down early Elvis, we'll talk to record producer Ernst Jorgensen. He's just put together a new 5-CD collection of Presley's complete recordings from the 50s, including some never-before-released tracks. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. After a day of escalating rhetoric, Iraq's ambassador said this evening that within the next day he expects his government to give a positive response to demands that UN inspectors be allowed inside a Baghdad building that may contain information about Iraq's war capabilities. NPR's Linda Fasulo has more on negotiations surrounding the standoff.
Ralphie Case, who is charged with dismantling Iraq's weapons of mass destruction, said earlier today that no compromise was possible in the standoff with Iraq. The UN is committed to its demand that the Agriculture Ministry be searched for possible weapons-related materials. Case also emphasized that time was running out for Iraqi compliance. "We cannot expect this matter to drag on indefinitely," he warned. Case has been holding discussions in New York with Iraq's UN ambassador, Abdelamir El-Ambari, and has conveyed the UN's position on the impasse. Case is scheduled to meet with the Iraqi envoy tomorrow. For National Public Radio, this is Linda Fasulo reporting.
More American warships were deployed in the Persian Gulf today. A U.S. Navy spokesman said that an amphibious battle group has joined other warships that are engaged in joint exercises with states in the region. The latest vessels bring the number of U.S. ships in the Gulf to 24. The spokesman, Lieutenant Rob Rain, said the arrival of the new battle group is not related to any increase in tension between the United States and Iraq. Yesterday, the Bush administration canceled port calls for 4 U.S. warships in the Mediterranean, including the aircraft carrier Saratoga. Today, in a federal court in Washington, D.C., prosecution and defense lawyers gave their opening arguments in the Iran-Contra trial of Claire George. George is the highest-ranking former member of the Central Intelligence Agency to face a jury as a result of the probe. John Greenberg has more.
Claire George is the former head of covert operations, that is, spying, at the CIA. He's accused of 7 counts of lying under oath to Congress and a grand jury, and 2 counts of encouraging another person to lie. The prosecution said he lied about his knowledge of the secret White House Contra supply operation run by Oliver North and about the arms for hostage swap with Iran. The defense said George was a non-political career CIA man who fell victim to a fight between a Democratic Congress and a Republican administration. The main witness against George, a former subordinate named Alan Fiers, was attacked by the defense as a liar. The defense said George believed that what he told Congress was the truth, even if it turned out later on to be wrong. The trial is expected to last about a month. For National Public Radio, this is John Greenberg in Washington.
Stock prices fell slightly today after a session of mixed trading in response to weakness in overseas markets and uncertainty over the Middle East. The Dow Industrials lost 4 points to close at 3,285. This is NPR News. 3 House Democrats said today that a probe of the House Post Office is a political witch hunt and said they'd refuse to answer questions under the Fifth Amendment. The 3 representatives are House Ways and Means Chairman Dan Rostenkowski, Austin Murphy, and Joseph Coulter. They announced their intentions in a letter to U.S. Attorney Jay Stevens. The 3 have been subpoenaed to appear before a grand jury next Tuesday. The representatives have called the probe a fishing expedition and said that a House report on mismanagement of the post office exonerated them of any wrongdoing. They referred particularly to an alleged scheme to exchange stamps for cash. Federal officials say 7 years of drought in the West could make this summer one of the worst for wildfires. NPR's Howard Berkus reports.
Many western forests, grasslands, and rangelands are as dry as they've ever been, say federal wildfire officials. They're gearing up. training 100 new fire crews, establishing a fire war room in Washington, D.C., assembling an army of fire trucks, planes, and helicopters, and maintaining a daily weather and fire watch nationwide. Fire officials fear that rainless lightning strikes, dry winds, and parched forest grasses and brush will combine this summer, setting off blazes too wild to control. They worry most about Oregon, Washington, and Northern California, but say the fire potential is also great in Idaho, Montana, Nevada, Colorado, and Utah. I'm Howard Berkus in Salt Lake City.
The government of Colombia has rejected a conditional surrender offer from escaped gangster Pablo Escobar. The reputed leader of the Medellin cocaine cartel said that he'll give himself up if the government meets a series of conditions. They include a provision that Escobar be returned to his luxury jail and that the original prison guards be reinstated. The government has said it will accept only an unconditional surrender from Escobar. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, T-Bone Burnett, is admired for the music he performs and the music he produces. He's a singer-songwriter-guitarist from Texas who writes sometimes witty, sometimes dark songs about contemporary life. He's made several highly regarded albums of his own songs. He's also produced albums by Elvis Costello, Roy Orbison, Los Lobos, and the Bodines. Columbia has just released Burnett's new album. It's his first in 4 years. It's called The Criminal Under My Own Hat. Burnett was just in Philadelphia for a performance. We invited him to our studio to talk with us and play a few tunes. Here's T-Bone Burnett in the Fresh Air studio, getting things started with a song that's also featured on his new album.
This is called It's Not Too Late, even though sometimes I'm not so sure. The wind turns like a dagger, the rain falls like a hammer. The sky has grown dark, but it's not too late. The weather crashes down, what's lost cannot be found. The night is closing, but it's not too late. It's not too late, it's not too late. It's not too late, it's not too late. The atmosphere is lethal, but I will feel no evil. The ocean rolls like thunder, the tempest pulls us under. The dogs are howling, but it's not too late. As broken structures rust, false idols turn to dust. All lies in ashes, but it's not too late. It's not too late, it's not too late. It's not too late, it's not too late. The atmosphere is lethal, but I will fear no evil. Dawn. The echo of the siren song dies away like a ghost as the day breaks. It's not too late, it's not too late. It's not too late, it's not too late. The atmosphere is lethal, but I will fear no evil.
That's a great song. Is there a story behind writing it?
No.
Well, let's end the interview then.
No, only that I got stuck on this song because, you know, it's. You may have noticed that all it talks about is how horrible everything is, and then it says it's not too late.
Right.
And I couldn't figure out why it wasn't too late, you know. And then I realized. Bob Neuwirth came in and started working on it, and I realized that the reason it wasn't too late is just because just the very act of looking at what's wrong is hopeful. You know, the thing that kills us is when we deny what's wrong.
Is this one of the songs that Elvis Costello wrote with you, too?
Yeah, well, then he came in and wrote the bridge. He came in and wrote the sort of, put the, you know, the very major hopeful bridge in there. So he finished it off.
So he's the one who put the optimism in?
Well, no, he's the one that put the, yeah, musically speaking.
Okay.
To say Elvis Costello is an optimist would be paltering with the truth, I must say.
The press release that accompanies your new record says that you took 3 years, it's described as a 3-year extended vacation during which you reassessed your musical priorities. What is that about?
Well, what I did, I just took 3 years off. I finished working on Spike with Elvis Costello.
You produced that for him?
I produced it with him, yeah. And I think I'd just about had enough. You know, I'd been working in the studio for 5 or 6 years straight. I hadn't really been out in public but a couple of times. And went back to Texas and thought and read a lot. Because, you know, living in Los Angeles, all events in the world conspire to make one think about everything he shouldn't be thinking about, I feel, especially so in Los Angeles, in the media capital of the world, where any little tremor is viewed as a cause for a 90-minute special on television. And things get blown way out of proportion, and it was I actually keep my residence in Texas and live in Texas for just that reason, because I don't want to start competing. For artists or for poets, and I use that in the most metaphorical sense of the word, to compete creates a metaphysical doubt that poisons everyone. The record companies are competing, the radio stations are competing, the critics are competing, the newspapers are competing, the record stores. It's all competition. It's all lists. What's the best record of the year? What are the 10 best records of the year? What's
right.
the selling the most? It's all competition. See, and you just have to somehow divorce yourself, or not even divorce yourself from it, just completely ignore it. So that's what that was about, going away and ignoring it.
Let me ask you to play another song is on your new record, and this is actually the song that opens up the new record. The album, I should mention, is called The Criminal Under My Own Hat, and my guest is T-Bone Burnett. And why don't you do the opening song, Over You?
Okay, Over to You.
There's a fine line between love and hate that we erased, that we erased. What started as a mask became a face. The pain untraced, the pain untraced. I've been a long time searching for you. I've been a long time breaking through. Gonna be a long time getting over you, over you. Standing in my doorway facing south, the moon comes up, the sun goes down. Wondering what this noise was all about. The dust blows in, the light blows out. I've been a long time looking for you. I've been a long time breaking through. Gonna be a long time getting over you, Down the road I see the fog roll in, as thick as fear, as dark as sin. We live in an age lit by lightning. After the flash, we're blind again. I've been a long time looking for you. I've been a long time breaking through. Gonna be a long time getting over you, over you, over you, over you.
It's a great song by my guest, T-Bone Burnett. And that's a song from his new album, The Criminal Under My Own Hat. I hear a lot of like folk influence in that song as well as rock and roll.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so what were you first listening to when you started to play?
Well, when I first started to play, I listened to Jimmy Reed, I guess.
Yeah. Oh.
Who, and Hank Williams, who I guess would both be folk music musicians. You know, Muddy
Waters. Blues, too.
Yeah, but you know, back then they called Muddy Waters folk music. But I guess that's just because folk music was happening at the time, and I think that's probably what the deal is about labels anyway. It's just a way to try to sell them, to identify them so that, you know, put them in a certain part of the record store or something.
So is that what you learned to play early on, that
kind
of stuff?
Yeah.
And were you in bands when you were young?
Just for a little while. I was in a band for about 6 or 8 months, and we decided to get a job that we should go make a record. And so we went into this recording studio called Clifford Herring Sound, where Hey Baby had been recorded by Bruce Chanel. It was you know, one of the 2 or 3 recording studios in Texas. And we recorded a song, and it was so much fun, we decided to buy the studio. So we bought the studio, and then that was the end of the band, basically, somehow, because I started, I guess, you know, I was 17 years old, and I had to start working.
You bought the studio?
Yeah.
When you were 17?
Yeah, 16 or 17, yeah.
Where'd you get the money?
Well, we borrowed it from the bank, you know. But back then studios weren't like they are today, you
right,
gotta remember.
Right.
Back then there were, you know, just a few little things. So we leased the space that it was in and bought the equipment.
Huh. So would you produce your own stuff or other people?
Yeah, well, we produced, there's a band called the Van Dykes, an R&B band that had a lot of hits. There's this guy, the legendary Stardust Cowboy, that's become kind of a something, I don't know what he is, you know, a obscure kind of famous person, if there's such a thing. And then, let's see, what else did we do? I don't remember what else we did. It was a long time ago.
Well, this helps explain how you ended up producing, too. I guess you were interested in it early on.
Well, the first gig, so to speak, I ever had was with the Rolling Thunder Review with Bob Dylan. That was the way I got started on the stage.
It's hard to think of that as being like a first gig.
Yeah.
How old were you?
Oh, I was 25 or something like that.
And how'd you get to be in it?
Well, they just called me up and said, you want to come play in this? I was friends with Bob Newirth, who was putting together the tour with Bob Dylan. And he sent me a ticket to New York and said, come play this, come play in my band, he said. And I said, sure, and it ended up being this other thing.
I just happened to have here a quote that I'm sure you've heard many times before, that Sam Shepard wrote about you after the Rolling Thunder tour, and he wrote about you that you have a peculiar quality of craziness about you. He said he's the only one on the tour I'm not sure has relative control over his dark side. What did Sam Shepard mean by that?
Well, maybe it must have been that night I cut through his door with a chainsaw.
Did you? Is that a joke?
Well, it was a joke, yeah, but no, I didn't. No, I don't know. He's right about that.
Has your relationship to your own dark side changed since then?
Yeah, I think, yeah, I try to look at it more. It's not any less dark than it ever was. I don't think that. Maybe darker, but it's not as free to run rampant as it once was. It's not scary either anymore, you know.
Did you do a lot of crazy things when you were younger?
Well, yeah. When I was at the Betty Ford Clinic. No, yeah, I did. I still do a lot. I do as much. I try to have a good time. You know, I try to stay loose. Not get too. I try not to get too worried about it all. Is that a good answer?
Well, not very forthcoming, but.
Oh, what are you? Well, I'm not. No, I don't believe in that. confessing all that. It doesn't matter. You know, you hear a lot of people like bragging about how bad they used
to be.
Yeah,
that's true.
You know, however bad I was, it was just a lightweight compared to the people who are really good at being bad.
Right, right. Is it too personal to ask if becoming a Christian changed your behavior or your relationship to your dark side?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think so, absolutely.
That it did or that it's too personal to ask?
No, it's not too personal to ask at all. No, it's, it's a long road. People talk about becoming a Christian like it's something that happens to you in 1 minute and then you're better the whole rest of your life and everything. I mean, or you're, you know, cured of all evil the rest of your life or something. I haven't found that to be true. In fact, I find trying to follow Christ is incredibly difficult and moment to moment. And it's that's the great thing about it, I think, is that particular road, is that it is moment to moment and difficult. It's not some easy solution to, you know, life. I don't know, it's such a long, hard subject to get into.
Yeah.
But, you know, I see people like, Tipper Gore, you know, and who seems to be a very nice lady, and I'd love to talk with her. I'd love to sit down and talk with her sometime. Or Donald Wildman or these people. Now, see, it seems to me these are people that don't want to look at their dark sides.
T-Bone, why don't we take a short break?
Okay.
And then we'll talk some more.
Okay.
And we'll hear some more music. And my guest is T-Bone Burnett, and he has a new album out called The Criminal Under My Own Hat. Is there a My Own in that? Own Hat.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah. And we'll take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. I'm with T-Bone Burnett, and before we hear some more music, I just want to ask you a couple of things about producing. You've produced records for a bunch of other people, including Elvis Costello and Roy Orbison. What are the big issues when you were producing for Roy Orbison? What were the issues about what to do, what kind of sound to get, decisions that you had to make about it?
Well, you know, each particular subject presents its own set of problems and strengths, you know. And Orbison, he had this huge legend that he was dragging around with him, you know. I think it was very difficult for him to get back in the studio in the first place. I think the one overriding.
This is around Blue Velvet time that you did this?
Yeah. The interesting thing about Orbison, and he's one of probably the few people that can say it, he was 50, I think, when he died, or 50-something. And he did all those songs in the same keys that he did them in originally.
That's amazing.
Yeah, so, I mean,
because he had an enormous range.
Yeah, he had a huge range. And he never opened his mouth. And he sang very, very quietly. Like, he just had so much resonance in his body and in his soul that those notes would come out huge. But they were incredibly quiet when he sang them. So he never strained his voice. Right. He never... overused it. George Jones is the same way. For that huge voice he has, he sings very quietly.
Now, what about producing with Elvis Costello? Different set of issues to deal with?
Absolutely. I mean, Elvis is the most engaged person I've ever met in my life and has 1,000 ideas that he wants to put down all at once, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So, and all of them should be put down, too. What you have to do with him is to try to help him get them down and then help him sort through them.
He was putting all those ideas probably in one set of lyrics too, right?
He can do that. He's got so many ideas. I hold Elvis in the highest regard, absolutely.
Yeah.
And he's got so many ideas that times he should write maybe. He's got songs that he should write songs for every verse or every line. You know? They're 10 songs in one.
You occasionally on your records put in a standard like you've done Diamonds Are a Girl's Best Friend, a pop standard. Now, I asked you if for your performance today on Fresh Air, if you would do a surprising standard for us, something that we might be surprised to hear from you. So you've got something picked out. Could you do it for us?
I'm going to try to do this with apologies. I do this with fear and apologies. This is a beautiful song by Rodgers and Hart. Which song was it? It seems that we have met like this before. We looked at each other in the same way then, but I can't remember where or when. The clothes you're wearing are the clothes you wore. The smile you were smiling then, but I can't remember where or when. Some things that happen for the first time seem to be happening again. So it seems that we have met before and laughed before and loved before, but who knows where or when.
I love to hear you do standards. How did you start start doing them?
I love those songs. I love, I guess I've heard these things all my life, haven't we all?
Well, I certainly did.
Yeah. And I started, when I started studying songwriting, I started looking back at a lot of these old songs.
Yeah.
That's what happened with me. I started trying to figure out ways to do them, which I never really figured out a way to do that when I just happened to love that song. Yeah. There's probably some way I could take it and make it more my own, you know, but I don't know how, actually. That's a deep song. Well, you got to do that. That song's got to be like a dream, you know. That song's a dream. It's a very, you know, it's all longing and distant and in the mist. And it's beautiful.
Thanks for being with us and for talking with us and playing for us. Really enjoyed it a lot.
So happy to be here.
And T-Bone Burnett's been my guest. He has a new album, and several of the songs he played are included on that album. It's called The Criminal Under My Own Hat. That's on Columbia Records. And I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
I've been waiting for a long, long time. I've been waiting for a long, long time. I've been waiting for a long, long time. I've been waiting for the long time now. I've been waiting for a long, long time. I've been waiting for a long, long time.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, we'll hear Elvis Presley records that were never released until now. One of them is the first record he ever made. These tracks are featured on a new 5-CD set called Elvis, The Complete 50s Masters. We'll meet the producer, Ernst Jorgensen, who's traveled around the world looking for rare Elvis recordings. New old music by Elvis coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. President Bush is flying to Camp David tonight to consider what the White House calls enforcement against Iraq because of its refusal to allow UN inspectors into a government building in Baghdad. Mr. Bush plans to meet tomorrow with top-level advisors. White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater called the standoff the most serious situation yet, an Iraqi defiance of UN resolutions. The president had planned to spend the weekend at his vacation home in Maine. Late this afternoon, the Iraqi envoy to the UN said that he believes there will be a positive response to the UN's final proposal to end the stalemate. Meanwhile, consensus is developing on Capitol Hill for an ultimatum backed by the threat of military force to make Iraq comply with UN resolutions on weapons inspections. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
Democrats and Republicans expressed cautious support today of increased pressure on Saddam Hussein. President Bush scrapped a visit to Kennebunkport this weekend and plans instead to summon national security advisors to Camp David tomorrow. Meanwhile, the Senate Intelligence Committee received a closed briefing on the status of Iraq's refusal to comply with Gulf War ceasefire requirements. Senator Sam Nunn, the Democratic chairman of the Armed Forces Committee who opposed the Gulf War, said today that military action should be seriously considered.
I think it's not enough simply to plan for one brief episode. We have to be able to plan for things that would go further than that. But that's in the planning stage, and again, I hope that he will back down as he has in the past.
Both Nunn and Republican Senator John Warner said today the president has been granted the authority to take whatever actions are required to force compliance. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the Capitol.
Before deciding to return to Washington, President Bush campaigned today in Brookville, Ohio. At one appearance, he highlighted his family values theme. Lorna Jordan of member station WVXU reports.
Mr. Bush used this small conservative Ohio town to urge people to change control of Congress, and at the same time he urged passage of term limits for Congress. He said that his administration changed the world during his first term. He still says foreign policy is important, but during his second term, Mr. Bush says he plans to change domestic policy. He mentioned few specifics. He also attacked Democratic presidential nominee Bill Clinton for wanting government to change family values. Mr. Bush says government can't do what the family can do. For National Public Radio, I'm Lorna Jordan in Brookville, Ohio.
Jesse Jackson will be campaigning in the state of Mississippi this weekend for the Democratic presidential ticket. Officials say that Jackson will also take part in a voter registration drive. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down more than 4 points to close at 3,285. This is NPR News. President Bush was heckled this morning by a group of families upset because the Bush administration has not provided more information about people still missing in Southeast Asia. At one point, Mr. Bush told a group of some 300 people to please shut up and sit down. Earlier this week, the president signed a bill ordering federal agencies to release files that did not invade the privacy of the missing servicemen's families. Yesterday, the Pentagon released thousands of documents in response to the president's order. In Bosnia, fighting continues in Sarajevo between Serbian troops and Bosnian militia as Serbian gunners shell the city. A UN convoy was trapped as it tried to reach a mostly Muslim city still under siege by Serbian forces. Matt Fry filed this report for the BBC.
Gorjda, a mainly Muslim town whose population has swollen by about 30,000 refugees, has been besieged by Serbian forces since the beginning of April. Reports say that conditions are dire. Corpses litter the streets and starvation is spreading. The UNHCR convoy, which left Sarajevo yesterday, was on a reconnaissance mission to prepare for a much larger UN relief operation. Yesterday, the small column of two armored vehicles and two trucks carrying 16 tons of food and medicines ran over two landmines. One person was lightly injured. Now the vehicles are trapped between minefields, unable to go forwards or backwards. A second armored convoy carrying mine-clearing equipment left Sarajevo this morning to try and dislodge the stranded convoy. If this rescue attempt fails, the UN may evacuate its staff by helicopter.
Matt Fry in Sarajevo. Officials in Britain have ordered three Iranians out of the country for national security reasons. According to news reports in London, the three are suspected of plotting to kill author Salman Rushdie. Two of the three work at the Iranian embassy in London. A third is on a student visa. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Okay, Elvis fans, you're about to hear some music that you've probably never heard before. It's included on the new 5-CD box set, The King of Rock and Roll, The Complete 50s Masters. The set includes every studio master take of Elvis Presley released during the 50s, as well as some alternate takes, early live tracks, and previously unreleased material. My guest is the producer of this new collection, Ernst Jorgensen. He's from Denmark, where he started listening to Elvis before he could even understand English. In a moment, we'll hear a track that's something of a revelation. It's not a professional recording. It was made in 1953, when Elvis was 18. He went to a studio in Memphis and paid $4 to make a recording of his voice. He sang two songs. The recording was discovered in 1988 in the collection of his old high school classmate. One of those songs, My Happiness, was recently released, but the one we'll hear, That's When Your Heartaches Begin, was never released until now.
The beauty about these two acetate recordings, and especially about That's When Your Heartaches Begin, is that you hear Elvis Presley before anybody got to him, before anything from the music industry really touched him. You hear him singing that song, and you realize that nobody taught Elvis how to sing, how to get that whole Elvis Presley magic onto tape. It was there from the very first day. It was part of his upbringing, not part of what the music business imposed on him.
Let's hear it.
If you find your sweetheart in the arms of a friend, that's when your heartaches begin. When dreams of a lifetime must come to an end, that's when your heartaches begin. Love is a thing you never can share. When you bring a friend into your love affair, that's the end of your sweetheart, that's the end. That's when your heartaches begin.
If you find your sweetheart in the arms of your best friend, brother, that's when your heartaches begin. And when dreams of a lifetime must all come to an end, yeah, that's when your heartaches begin. You see, love is a thing that you never can share. And when you bring a friend into your love affair, that's the end.
You know, the recitation that Elvis does at the end of this recording, it almost sounds like an Elvis impersonation, because he's obviously doing it in character. Do you know how he started doing that kind of recitation? I mean, obviously he was doing it before he ever recorded anything commercially.
I don't really, just with like the whistling on a few of those early recordings, on I Love You, because it was in the time there were people who did that, and Elvis picked up anything that was interesting, whether it was from black music or white music or for religious music. You can see that in other situations, like when he does Milk Cow Blues, Boogie at Sun, he and Sam Phillips came up with this idea of you do it slow and then you say, well, hold on a minute, whatever he's saying, and then he speeds up that whole thing. All those little what you'd probably call commercial ideas that were around mm-hmm. somewhere, Elvis picked them up and integrated them into his own music.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Ernst Jorgensen, who is the producer of the new series Elvis, the King of Rock and Roll, and it's the complete 50s masters of Elvis's recordings. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Ernst Jorgensen is my guest. He's from Denmark, and he's the producer of a new 5-CD set of Elvis recordings from the 1950s. Let's get to another previously unrecorded side that you have on the new collection of CDs. This is Fool, 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 recorded in 1955. How did you get access to this?
There was a rumor like 10 years ago that a song called What a Fool I Was had been played by Elvis's record producer, Felton Jarvis, who since died. But nobody was able to track it down. But I had this friend in Nashville who insisted that he'd heard it, and he's a very credible guy. And I looked everywhere. I went to Jarvis's wife. I went to Nashville. I looked for it all over the place. Just to realize that when I went through the doors at the business department at RCA, places where people would never go, there was a small letter actually relating to the matter. And we called this guy up who lives in Texas and said, did he still have that acetate? And said, sure. And we got it in, and it blew our mind, because this is Elvis very early in his career doing R&B with his two musicians. And the story that goes with it is fabulous, because Leroy, as the gentleman is called, in 55, worked in Texas setting up gigs for artists, and Elvis approached him at the time and said he'd really like to do some gigs in Texas. It was a very early day, so he was basically playing in the neighborhood of where he was living. And Elvis went over to his place with his two musicians, and this guy had a facility to do lacquers, and he liked that old Clovis song, Fool, Fool, Fool. So I said to Elvis, do you know this song? And Elvis said, sure. And I think it's a vital historical piece here, because it shows how you went from That's When Your Heartaches Begin and the ballads and the early stuff, and actually developed that fusion of R&B and hillbilly music. It's all here, and it's three people, and it's just unrehearsed. It just shows you how natural this music was to Elvis.
Why don't we give it a listen? This is Fool, Fool, Fool.
Fool, 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 that I was too old for you. Well, fool, well, what a fool I was to think that you could love me too.
Well, when I first met you, baby, well, I knew I couldn't win. But I just kept on trying, 'cause trying is no sin. But I knew that I was too far. Well, oh, what a fool I was to think that you could love me.
That's Elvis Presley from the new 5-CD set, Elvis the King of Rock and Roll. My guest is the producer of the set, Ernst Jorgensen. So what was your reaction the very first time you heard this? It must be just like finding treasure to somebody like you.
Yeah, I was so nervous that the lacquer wouldn't play on the way through that I don't think I heard it the first time, but I loved it. I thought it was if not like a missing link, it stressed one of the points that we've been trying to make on this box, that Elvis really knew what he was doing himself, that he had this style. It wasn't forced on him. This was his natural way of singing and playing. And I think this one is this goes well with the development of his son career. It all fits in and makes the whole thing more credible.
Let me ask you: when you get your hands on a rare disc, are you in a panic until you've had a chance to put it on tape?
Yeah, I'm desperate, but we're very careful with that. When we make sure that no risks are involved in this. We do it with the utmost care when we play them back, and we run a digital tape as soon as we play it the first time, because if it won't play the second time and stuff like that.
My guest is Ernst Jorgensen, producer of the new box set, The King of Rock and Roll, The Complete 50s Masters. More in just 60 seconds. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Linda, what do you have on the possible bombing of Iraq?
Well, the situation is growing increasingly tense, and the possibility that the United States and the Allies may act is increasing. Deborah Amos will be reporting on what has happened today. We'll have reaction from around the world, a report from London, and we have had a call into Baghdad to see what it feels like to be in that city as the world turns its attention to Iraq again. The AIDS meeting in Amsterdam is ending today. We'll have a story on that. We're going to take a look at a Mexican soap opera translated into Russian, but the big story is Iraq.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. We're back with Ernst Jorgensen, producer of a new 5-CD collection of Elvis Presley recordings from the 50s. Did you find some of the Elvis reissues of the past unsatisfactory in the way they were remastered?
I found basically most of them unsatisfactory. There were two problems. One was that not a lot of effort and thought had been put into getting a prime source. People seemed to be content with taking whatever tape they found, not checking whether it was an electronic stereo, whether it was like a fourth generation with a lot of hiss on it. That was one problem. The other problem was that a number of engineers thought they needed to reinvent the sound of these recordings, so they equalized them or compressed them, so they changed the whole beauty of those original recordings.
Is there something you'd like to hear played from the From the box set that's an example of a really good master that you found that preserves the original integrity of the sound?
Yeah, without trying to be arrogant, I think you could do that for the whole box. But there's always personal highlights, and I think we found an original master tape of the song called "My Baby Left Me" and all those songs from that same session that nobody played since '56. And when you listen to that, you can hear the vast difference between what you heard and what you hear now, and I think you will agree that this is still credible. You can believe that this is the way Elvis heard, and that's the way he wanted it to sound.
Let's hear it.
Something I've done, something that she heard. baby even left me, never said a word. Play it, blues boy.
So where did you find this master?
This one was actually in the vault, but a lot of the other stuff we found wasn't.
Well, wait a minute. If it was in the vault, how come nobody else had used it?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I think if I go further into that, I will criticize some people very dramatically. A lot of stuff we found outside, we were very lucky that some of the people involved with those original Presley sessions kept tapes as well.
You mean like people in the session?
Basically the engineers of those sessions.
Oh.
Elvis did a lot of recording sessions at a studio called Radio Recorders in Hollywood. At the time, they always had two tape machines running, so there were two sets of prime tapes. And Thorne Noga, who ran all those sessions, had kept one of the sets for all those years, never played them, and he was very cooperative when I contacted him. He really wanted us to get access to his tape, because whatever we did to our tapes, they were not there anymore. And we've used those. We've talked to him on how exactly they should sound, how they sounded at the time. We did the same thing with the Sam Phillips stuff from Sun. We went down to Sam Phillips, played it to him, said, are we on the right track here? Is this what you heard in those days? Is this an accurate way of doing it? And that is what guided the whole process. We couldn't talk to Elvis about it. We couldn't talk to the original A&R man, Steve Sholes, because they're not around anymore. So what was our main principle here was Elvis always approved the masters in the studio, and he often complained about how they sounded when they came out later on record or on the radio. So that was our guideline. If we could find the original prime, that was what Elvis really liked, and he thought that's the way it should sound. So that's what's on this box. And some of it is incredible. Some of the skills of those engineers is unbelievable by today's standards, not to put anybody down. But if you listen to stuff from the King Creole sessions where there's like 17 people playing at the same time, like three singers, two drummers, three guitarists, a horn section of four people, all recorded direct live onto a mono tape. It's mind-blowing. I mean, the way the drums come forward, the way where you can hear everything in there, and Elvis is still up there in front. It's fabulous. I think we should really listen to a very sexy classic hip cut called Trouble.
Sounds like a good idea.
If you're looking for trouble, you came to the right place. If you're looking for trouble, just look right in my face. I was born standing up and talking back. My daddy was a green-eyed mountain jack. So don't you mess around with me. I never looked for trouble, but I never ran. I don't take no orders, no kind of man. I'm only made out of flesh, blood, and bone. But if you're gonna start a rumble, don't you try at all alone, because I'm evil. My little name is Marie. Well, I'm evil. So don't you mess around with me.
What a the records that you think of as having been inflicted on him by producers or record companies? Material that he didn't want to record or styles that he didn't want to record in?
I think there's few traces of that in the 50s period, but it becomes very evident in the 60s where they made those film deals. I think that Elvis really wanted to be a serious movie actor, and they tried it. They did Flaming Star, Wild in the Country, and King Creole, but it didn't do well at the box. Those films didn't do well at the box office, so they made those movie contracts. It was a lot of money, and then they got caught. They got trapped in there. They had to do them. They made the deals. They made the money from doing them, and that's where Elvis gave up. I think he gave up on those soundtracks because he did two or three movies a year. He had to come up with like from between 8 to 14 songs on three movies per year. And he said, well, there's no way in the world that we can get enough good songs. So in the 60s, I think that where Elvis really cared about his music were the studio sessions he did for RCA that had nothing to do with the movie soundtracks.
Is there an Elvis tape or, you know, disc that you're searching for that after all these years you still haven't gotten your hands on but you know exists?
Yes, there's a lot of that. There's actually 50s material we're searching for, and certainly 60s and 70s. The problem for us working with it, going into details as to what they are, is that it's going to create so much anxiety with the collectors that we're going to have so many letters asking what it is and when are we going to get it, that until we have it, we don't go into details. But we've located stuff. We know where it is. But not all people are very easy to deal with on that.
So this is the top secret Elvis.
There is a top secret Elvis scenario. And there will always be, there's always going to be the next guy who, for whatever reason, forgot about the tape he had that he did back in 50 or 60-something. And suddenly, because he sees all the publicity around the 50s box, say, oh, my God, I need to talk to these guys about these tapes. And that happens all the time.
Well, Ernst Jorgensen, thank you very much for talking with us.
That's been great.
Ernst Jorgensen is the producer of the new 5-CD set, The King of Rock and Roll, The Complete 50s Masters, on RCA Records. Today's show is engineered by Richard Parker and Audrey Voblaitis. I'm Terry Gross.
If you find your sweetheart in the arms of a friend, that's when you're...
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk about acting and hard times with Danny Aiello. He recently starred in the film Ruby about the man who shot JFK's assassin. It just came out on video. Aiello also starred as the owner of the pizzeria in Do the Right Thing and as Cher's intended in Moonstruck. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.